I'm Lee Gaylord. I wrote a book called The Crazy Old White Man from the Hood. It is an autobiography. A few years ago, a friend of mine said that I should write a book about my experiences. He is a playwright and wanted to do a play on the book when I wrote it. I lost track of him, though, and it is not a play. In the streets, I was known as a crazy old white man. Today, I am Mr. Lee in the streets. The book starts off about my childhood. 2 years in Atlanta in the mid-50s made me what I am today. The rest of my childhood was fun for me, and I am sure you will enjoy it. I also talk about the Navy and my two wives, but most of the book is about Detroit and the drug culture. You will meet drug addicts and drunks. You will meet people of the streets. You will see my ups and downs. The last time I went down, I realized that that was where God wanted me to be, so I could help others find their way out of the pits that they dug for themselves. You will see a world that most people do not want to talk about. You will see the invisible people who people walk past and do not see. I pull no punches in the book, and you will see good, the bad, and the ugly, not only in Detroit, but in most cities of this country. You will also see the good, the bad, and the ugly in me. You will laugh, and you will cry. You will see how I survived some of the most dangerous parts of the most dangerous city in the U.S. I have spent the last 50 years studying life and people from all walks of life. I have friends who are on the bottom of our society. For a few years, I was a drunk, not an alcoholic. I quit getting drunk because I realized it was not the way to escape. The way to escape was to get out of the situation. The book is dedicated to my father, who saved my life after he passed away. I learned not to hurry and not to worry. My father would say, "If you can't do anything about it, don't worry about it." He was right. I follow that philosophy, and I haven't had a bad day since. Life is what you make of it, and it is my hope that the book will help those who are down find their way back up. And it is my hope that you enjoy the book and learn from it. Thank you. This is a crazy old white man from the hood, and I'm going to read to you chapter one.
Earlier years were not too exciting. I remember listening to the radio before we got TV. Old radio shows with their sound effects that let you visualize who's in your mind and what was happening in the stories. I remember my father's 1949 Buick. And when you got stuck in the snow, you would push a button and cinders would cover the snow behind the tires. My father always bought the cheapest house in the most expensive neighborhoods. We lived in wealthy neighborhoods. I went to parties at mansions and country clubs. Many of my friends had swimming pools in their backyard. I was hobnobbing with the rich kids, whose fathers were in some cases famous. In the mid-1950s, I lived in Atlanta, Georgia for 2 years. 11 to 13 years old. I changed my life in a way that I really did not notice until about 25 years later. At the time, Atlanta was segregated. I call it apartheid. Water fountains were brown and white, as were the bathroom doors. I had to ride in the front of the bus. The blacks I saw were maids, dishwashers, elevator operators, busboys, porters, laborers, and other low-paying jobs. Or were on the chain gang. Blacks could not eat in white restaurants unless it was in the kitchen. Even the churches were segregated. My father's office was at a truck yard and a warehouse for a big nationwide trucking company. He ran their truck leasing operation. On Saturdays, I would go with him to work. I found myself talking to the guys who load and unload the trucks. They were all black. The restrooms had brown and white doors. The brown doors were for blacks and the white doors were for whites. I had to go, so I headed for the restroom. Closest men's room had a brown door on it, but I was in a hurry. Black man said, "Mr. Lee, go to the white restroom. The white man and might kick your ass if he catches you." I said, "That's too far. I gotta go now." Luckily, the white man didn't see me. I was on the bus. The bus was full. And I was on the line between and the black and white sections. An old black lady got out and was standing by me. Since my seat was on the border, I figured I'd give it to her. She said, "No, sir, please stay seated." The old redneck next to me said, "You get up and I'll kick your ass." What really made me mad was I preferred the back of the bus. I lived just outside the city limits. One day, some white men with shotguns and black men with stripes and shackles were walking down the street, picking up trash, patching holes, cutting the weeds on the city's property. It's funny that all the white guys looked like fat rednecks chewing tobacco and spitting on the street with brown uniforms and shotguns. I walked up to the closest guy with a shotgun and asked, "What do these guys do to get on the chain gang?" He answered, "A lot of crimes, including armed robbery and murder." I went back to my yard. My best friend lived with his family at stables behind my house. They were the caretakers for a judge who owned the stables. They were black and lived in a one-room stone house with dirt floors, no electricity, and running water. There was a potbelly stove in the middle of the room for heat and cooking, and an ice box for refrigeration. And they had some crops, chickens, cows, and pigs for food. He was a couple years older than me, about 15. He did not go to school. I asked my mother, "Can Billy come to?" I asked his mother, "Can Billy come to my house and play?" She said, "No, Mr. Lee. He can't go to your house." I said, "My parents said it would be okay with them." She said, "Mr. Lee, the white folks around you would turn against you and your family. Best not let any of them know that you even come down here." The judge asked you about, and I thought I was going to hit. Asked about you, and I thought I was going to have to send you home, but the judge said it was all right and not to worry. He had a little bull calf. One day Billy said, "You want to ride the little bull?" "Sounds like fun to me, Billy. Let's do it." We put the 2x4 boards across both openings of the barn, had the calf in the middle. I got on and it took off from one end to the other. We figured it would turn around at the end. But it went right through the bottom boards. The top board hit him in the gut, stopped me. Billy called to me, "You okay, Lee? Just lay there for a minute. We'll see how you are." I was out of breath. I had no choice but to lay there for a while. I was okay. I looked at Billy and said, "Your turn, Billy." Calf didn't go far, and we brought it back. This time, we went to the corral that had more room, and we rode him there. Okay. There were no more injuries, except for a few bruises. We did have fun, though. We not only rode the bull calf. My mother wasn't too happy about the bumps and bruises, but we rode horses and pigs, too. I was always bringing home rabbits, birds, snakes, lizards, and turtles. One day I was watching TV playing a 3-foot green snake that I had. The kid next door came and asked me to come out and play. I forgot about the snake. It was in a large planter on the table, and I went out. My mother came into the room, saw the snake on the table. She picked it up, took it in my room, put it in its cage. After coming out of the room, she realized what she did and screamed. Where I lived, we had woods and ponds. We built forts, rafts, and dams. We would swim in the ponds. And there was a pool within walking distance of from my house. I had a soapbox derby racer. And I could go miles with it because of all the hills. Cops pulled me over one time for speeding. I had a friend whose bedroom had glass wall open to the balcony. And you could see the Chattahoochee River about 500 feet below. We would go down and wade in the river. We would find Civil War artifacts in the woods. I found a Civil War bayonet, but it was lost on the move back to St. Louis. You could see Atlanta in the distance. It looked like a castle on a hill. Atlanta was a beautiful city, but the bigotry made it ugly. I had a lot of fun, but I saw how my race could be so stupid as to think that they are the human race and the blacks were inferior animals. When I left Atlanta, we went back to St. Louis, where I spent most of my childhood. I went into high school and found that I preferred being with the blacks. High school was one-third black. I did not date much because I was attracted to the black girls, and I could not date them. The black guys became my friends in school, but we could not mix outside the school. I had some white friends that lived near me. When I was in high school, the teachers would always tell my parents that I was so nice and so good. I never got caught. I wasn't really bad, but I wasn't an angel either. When my mother worked, I would skip school and have poker parties at the house. I wouldn't play, but I would collect a fourth of the pot. I sold cinnamon flavored toothpicks, candy, and other things. One time I made a box filled with wires, rolled up. Each had two connectors. I told the guy to run a wire from the TV, the antenna wire from the TV to the box, and then hook that to the antenna on the other side of the box. I told him TV reception would be a lot better. He paid me $10 for it. Next day, he said it worked great. My best friend was Ben. He was an artist. His work was 1930s cars in small towns. He also had a collection of old car parts. And he used his works of art. Did he use his works of art? I talked to him a few years ago, and now he's an artist and a hippie in Vancouver. Jim lived two doors down from me. He used to live next door to my dad's partner, whose son Bob was my age. When I went to Bob's house, Ben, who lived near Jim, and Bob would come over, and we had a lot of fun causing hate and discontent. One night, Jim said, "The man on the corner with the tennis court won't let us cut through his yard. Let's get to Jerry's house." I said, "We can't let him get away with that. What if someone whacks his tennis court?" We went out and got a bunch of cheap candles. At 2 a.m, we went to his tennis court, rubbed the candles all over the court. 7 years later, I was in another state working in a print shop at a college I went to. The new president came in. I heard he lived near where I used to live. I said, "I think I used to live near you. I lived in Orson Woods." He said, "I lived in Kirkwood. Here's my house." And I looked at the picture, and there's a tennis court beside it. And I realized he was the one we waxed. Small world, isn't it? Bob moved out of town. Jim moved two doors down from me. Ben had a 1935 Ford four-door and a 1949 Chevrolet. It was first hydromatic sold. 1935, it was in good shape. And 1949 was multicolored, and they named it Halitosis. On the rear, it said, "Halitosis is better than no breath at all." Jim had a 31 Ford sedan. I just had my mother's 60 Falcon. We went into the grocery store and went to the meat counter. Ben and Jim got on their hands and knees and were slowly running their hands on the floor and looking closely at the floor. I went to the meat counter and started throwing the meat around. The manager came running up to me and asked, "What do you think you guys are doing?" I looked at him and said, "I'm sorry about the confusion, sir, but my friend lost his contact lens." "Oh, what can I do to help?" I answered, "Keep everyone away from the area. We need brooms. My two friends will watch as your stock boys slowly and lightly sweep the floor. I didn't find them here, so I am sure that it's on the floor. Step very carefully. I will get on my hands and knees and make sure that you don't step on it." So we got the brooms and the stock boys and others. Customers kept from going through. A crowd gathered. People asked, "What are they looking for?"
"A contact lens."
"What's a contact lens?"
"It's a lens that goes in your eye instead of glasses."
"Doesn't that irritate the eye?"
"No, they put a liquid in the eye to keep it from irritating it."
Finally, Jim said, "I found it." He acted like he picked it up and put it in his eye and even got a little tear coming out of his eye. I thanked the manager, everyone else for their help, and we left. The meat counter was a mess. The floor was full of piles of dirt. The people were standing and still trying to figure out what happened. We got outside and started laughing. We laughed so hard that it hurt. From fifth grade through ninth grade, I was the biggest guy in school. Fifth and sixth grade, I played YMC football. I played tackle on defense. I went to for the quarterback, and he rarely had time to pass. On offense, I cleared a hole for the runner. I held, step back, and block for a pass or trade with the fullback when we needed to gain 3 yards or less. Once they knew I was coming, I could only make 2 yards. Whenever it was fourth and two or less, we would go the 2 yards for the touchdown. For a touchdown, I would be fullback. Sometimes, to surprise the other team, I would go around that. That was 2 yards for the first down, by the way. Don't know why I didn't catch that. My sophomore year ended my dynasty. Jack came to my school. He weighed 350 pounds and was not fat. You could hit him in the gut and he would not flinch. Your hand would hurt and he would laugh at you. I weighed 250. In football practice, he would be against me because I was the closest to him in weight. In tackling practice, he would pick me up and throw me down like I was nothing. In blocking practice, he would hit me and knock me up in the air and on my back. Luckily, I got a bad case of blood poisoning and was out too long to stay on the team. Jack was second in the nation in AAU wrestling. So I did not go out for wrestling because I would have to wrestle against him. I played sandlot football. We played it with few rules, tackle, no equipment. We sometimes had a bigger crowd than the high school. There was no adult supervision, so we had no problem with the parents pushing the kids or crying and when the kid got hurt. One of the high school players tried to play but broke his leg. After that, the coach said that he would throw any player off the team if they played with us. When I turned 16, Jack and I were good friends. We would go to a drive-in restaurant and find a car with four or five guys in it and piss them off. They would chase us, and we would get tired of the chase and pull off the road. They would pull up behind us, and we would get out of the car and start toward their car, and they would take off. Jack bought a stick shift car. Never drove one before. I showed him how to drive it, and we were on our way. He came up to a stoplight, and it turned green, and he stalled. Guy behind us started blowing his horn, which made it worse. Jack got out of the car and went back to the car behind us. Before the guy could raise the window, Jack had his keys and threw them in the lake next to the road. He came back to the car and we drove off with no problem. Never had a problem again. Another time, a guy behind us has bright lights on us. We flashed back with the rearview mirror, and we came to a red light, and Jack got out with a hammer, went to the car and knocked out the headlights, came back in the car, and we drove off. He was a nice guy, but he didn't want to piss him off. John was 6'7". He weighed 450 pounds. He wore a size 24 Triple E shoe. His parents had a 1953 Packard limo and a checker, All model years look the same, so I don't know what year it was. Those are the only cars that he could get into the back seat with. He did not play sports because he had a bad heart. He spent most of his time at home. I visited John often, and sometimes his mother would pick me up when I hitchhiked home from school. Three of us could have had a lot of fun if John could have joined us. We would not be able to get into our cars. He did not drive. When Jack and I would get stuck in the snow, one of us was not driving, would sit on the trunk, and the other would drive right out. I had a friend, Barry, from third to fourth grade, and I hadn't seen him since. I went to his house, and he was there. We were both happy and to see each other again. He had a 1936 Packard hearse with a casket carrier that we used as a cooler for parties. The top looked like the top of a casket. We came to a light, and a guy jumped out of the back. I jumped out with a starter pistol, shot him. He fell, and the driver and I threw him back into the casket. We looked back, and nobody moved. I talked to Barry and later Ben and Jim about getting old cars and staging a 1930s mafia hit downtown. We decided that we might get in too much trouble for it. It would also be easy for the cops to catch us on the old cars. So we decided not to go through with it. I love amusement parks and carnivals. The roller coaster is my favorite. Second is a scrambler. When I was in high school, I worked for a carnival, setting up, running, and tearing down. After a last ride, the workers would get in the scrambler. It had three long arms off the center and three arms off the end of those long arms. And there were tubs with three seats on the end of those. You went in a triangle. The governor would be taken off so that we could go twice as fast. One person on the ride would grab a hat from someone in the crowd, and we'd play pass the hat. I would set up and run and tear down rides. The Catholic church fairs were the best. I could send a kid to get a beer at the concession stand, and they would give him the beer for me. Many times, we would have a large cooler with beer in the middle of the merry-go-round. We would hop on and when it was running and get our beer. When running a ride, girls would ask for free rides. I would say, a ride for a ride. They usually said no. The worst part about working as a roustabout was that when the kids lost their lunch on a ride, I ran a ride and I would jump on it when I started it, jump off when it was time to stop. I got on one time, and the kid next to me said, "Aren't you the guy running the ride?" I said, "Yes." And he threw up on me. One time, when we were tearing down, I was on a center pole for the merry-go-round. It was on a hill, and a truck was back up to it. I was on a gear on the top, and I was taking a big gear off. I had to pull it up around my body and over the pole. As I was trying to get it into the truck, it got stuck between the top of the truck and the pole and pinned me to the pole. Truck was going to pull up enough to get me to get the gear in. Before it went forward, it rolled back and the pole started to tip. I could feel that it was ready to fall, with me between it and the ground. Truck went forward just on time. Needless to say, I didn't do that job anymore. Being a roustabout is fun, but it's hard and dangerous work.
That's the end of chapter one. Chapter two will follow, and that is when I was in the Navy. So listen to it as soon as you can. This is a crazy old white man from the hood, and you are about to hear chapter two, the Navy.
To the Navy. After high school, I went into the Navy. I came home on leave, and Ben and I went to a club we used to go to. When we went there, or before, it was a jazz club with a good jazz band. Now it was a coffee house for beatniks and folk music. Ben gave the owner some pictures that he painted, and she was going to put them on the wall. And as she sold them, she was going to split the money with them. Pictures were gone. She denied that she ever had them. The bass player from an old band was there, and he said she sold them. Ben was drafted. He was a pacifist by nature. He got out of boot camp with orders for Vietnam. He went home on leave and said goodbye to his parents and friends and went to Seattle. From there, he went to Vancouver. He is still considered a fugitive by our government. He has an art shop and is still an artist and a hippie. I talked to him a few years ago, but lost his number. I hope to locate him, and maybe he will write a book on his story. What he told me would make a good book. High school was a drag for me. I had poor grades, and I knew I wasn't ready for college when I graduated, so I joined the Navy to see the world. Furthest I got out of the U.S. was Key West, Florida. It was closer to Cuba than the Florida mainland. Boot camp was bad for me. I am not the kind who likes to take orders from ignorant people. I got in trouble in boot camp twice. The first time, I had to start over again. The second time, I was honest about a drill instructor and was sent to Mickey Mouse, where I spent 2 weeks washing clothes and exercising. When I got out of Mickey Mouse, they screwed up. Instead of putting me back where I was or making me start over again, they put me where I would be if I did not go there. So I skipped 2 weeks. When I got out of boot camp, I went to the electrician's mate school. Weekends, I would go to Chicago and people watch. I would sleep in a mission, Greyhound bus depot, or if I had money, I'd pay $1.25 a night for the YMCA. I hung out in an arcade where I shot pool, and a girl called Meet and Eat and a burlesque theater and Skid Row. I met George in the arcade. I was shooting pool. I was bad, too. Not the good bad. I stunk. George just got out of Leavenworth. He was a martial arts instructor in the Army. He was jumped by three guys and killed them in a fight. He was convicted of second-degree murder. George was having a hard time finding a job. Not many employers hired ex-cons. They were convicted of murder. He had a wife and three kids to support. We teamed up to hustle pool on weekends. I was a bad player, and he was almost and he was playing almost as bad. for my part, I did not have to sandbag. I was bad. In his case, he had to play bad. In reality, he was one of the best I've seen. I let him have my cut because I didn't need it. There's a hooker, Jane. Jane was 7 months pregnant and not working the streets or trade. She was out there panhandling. She became close to George and I, and we would help her when we could. We would meet at the meet and eat, and she would eat with us. We would buy her food. I walked in one day, and she was with a couple of her friends on from the street. I went up to her, yelled at her. She was in on it, by the way. Put my hand to her face, and I slapped my hand loudly, and she screamed and acted like it really hurt her. Everyone in the place thought I smacked her hard. Then I walked out. No one said anything. No one really seemed to care. I had been out of boot camp for a couple of months. My hair was fully grown back from boot camp. I was in Chicago on the last weekend of Liberty before graduation. I saw three boots. First, boot camp Liberty. Getting ready to go after two good-looking women. One looked in her mid-20s. And the other was 34. She told me her age later. I was 18. And the other guys were about 18. I went up to the boots as they were ready to make their move. They looked up at me because I was an old salt. No, of course, only 4 months older. But I said, there are three of you and two women. Don't you see that you have a problem? They each agreed that there was a problem. I was going to make a problem first. One of the girls was pretty and sexy. The other one was pretty. The pretty one looked like more intelligent of the two. I decided I wanted the pretty one. So I picked the boot that had the most sense to get the sexy one. And the other two were out. I told the lucky boot that I had decided that I wanted the pretty one and he could have the sexy one. There were two problems. First of all, I had to get rid of his buddies. Second, he had to pay for all four of us. We went to the movie and dinner, and the girls asked us to go with them to the pretty girl's house. We went on the train and to one of the suburbs. The boot and I did not get lucky. We had a good time, but no sex. I liked the girl, and I was with, but she figured I was too young for her. Sexy one came back with us on the train. She told the boot that she liked me and asked him to leave us alone. I told her that I was going home on leave and then to Key West, so I would not be able to see her again. She asked for my address, and I gave it to her, and she gave me hers. We kissed and developed into letting our fingers do the walking. 2 years later, she sent me a letter saying that she was going to visit a friend in Miami. She wanted to come and see me in Key West. She would get a motel room, and we could continue where we left off. I told her that it would be fine with me, but it may be the last time we would see each other. I was getting out of the Navy in less than a year, and I was not sure where I was going. She said it was okay with her. She had thought about me and wanted my body. Frankly, I wanted hers too. After our night together, she went back to Chicago. I got a letter a week later, and she said she loved me and wanted me to come to Chicago when I got out of Navy. I wrote back and said no. So she got upset and told me that if she could not have me, no one else would. She would find me wherever I went, and she would get rid of any woman I was with. This worried me. I sent her a nice letter letting her know that I was not scared and told her to leave me alone. Never heard from her again. In the Navy, some called me Rackets. I would make money by taking duty for the married men so that they could be home with their wives. I had a deal with the storekeeper to short out his lights so that I could take, so he could take a nap, and I would come back when he was rested to fix the lights. I got tools and payment. One thing that helped me in the Navy was that I knew what I was doing, and my immediate superiors liked me. We had a captain for part of the time who was Old Mustang. Old Mustang started at the bottom, worked our way up the ladder. The lights went out in his quarters. I tried to trace the wires to a fuse box, but I could not find it. I found a place to wire it into, but it was hot too, and I could not find a fuse box for it. My division officer, who was fresh from officer's candidate school, was not too swift. He was bugging me as I was trying to rewire the lead to the lights. I was working with live wires. I did not need the pain in my derriere that he was causing. Luckily, the captain was there and noticed the problem. He told the division officer that I knew more than he ever would about my job and to leave me alone. He wasn't too happy, but he left me alone, and I got the job done. I was transferred to the engine room, which was very hot, between 110 and 130 degrees. My engine room was powering the electricity in the ship. An engine went out, and the power went out. I was running back and forth between electric panels to get the power back. I had to adjust the speed of the three engines so that they were running at the same revolutions per minute. The captain got in my way, and I ran over him. An officer tried to stop me, and the captain stopped him and told him that I was right. The power was more important than he was. Halfway to New Orleans, our propulsion motors and generators went out. My job was to jury-rig them so that we could get to New Orleans. Enough parts were shipped to New Orleans to repair them, so we could make the trip back to Key West. For the 4 days there, I was working on 12 hours a day. I had to work on the bilges. They were full of oily water. And at times, the captain would get in his coveralls and hand me tools. This is one reason I'm using a capital C for the word captain. He deserves it. Our next captain's brain was not fully functional. When hurricanes came, we had to go out to sea. Our new captain was on submarines and never commanded a large ship. We went to sea to outrun the hurricane. On the way back, the captain went to the wrong harbor. When he found the right harbor, He was bringing the ship into the harbor. The winds were still too high to come in, but he came anyway. The wind was pushing us to the pier, and a tugboat was trying to keep us away from the pier. The wind won, and we hit the pier. Our ship had a big hole in the side. We were on our way to Fort Lauderdale and some target practice. There was a small ship that we were supposed to shoot at. We shot at it and missed. Next morning, the headline was that the Russian trawler was fired on by one of our ships. Of course, we denied it. Australian frigate captains did not like to use tugboats. They also did not like to waste time. When a frigate was supposed to tie up between our bow and another pier, we had to parallel park. He had to parallel park his frigate in front with no room to spare. When he got into position, he called a head full on starboard and all back full port, and the props on both sides went all ahead full. It took a few hours and three tugs with steel cables to pull them off the pier. You could see the steel cables stretching. We stayed low, ready to hit the deck if one broke. A French destroyer was coming in one time. They used a gun to shoot the lines to the pier. The monkey fist, which is a ball at the end of a smaller line, was shot ashore and picked up to pull a bigger rope to tie the ship to the pier. The first one went too far. It went through the admiral's window and landed on his desk. He was sitting at his desk. I have never seen an admiral move so fast. By the time the gangplank was up, he was on the French ship yelling at the captain. The French were underway in the middle of the harbor when a French sailor came up in a cab. He jumped in the water and swam out to his ship. And they threw a ladder down for him to climb aboard. One thing I learned about the Aussies and the French, they could drink. The French had wine on their ship with their meals. The Aussies had rum. The Dutch had beer. We had homemade wine and what we could smuggle onto the ship. Took a watermelon and cut a hole in it and emptied a fifth of vodka into it. That is the only way I like vodka. There is a Russian vodka liqueur, though, that's good. We had a torpedo man who caught his wife with another man. He decided he wanted to kill himself. He dropped a torpedo warhead 8 decks, but it didn't go off. He then lit a fire underneath the torpedo warhead. He started a torpedo's motor, and it shot across the torpedo room on the floor and hit the bulkhead. None of his attempts worked. He knew they wouldn't, but wanted out. He was given a psycho discharge, sent to a VA hospital for treatment. When I was in Key West, I had a motorcycle and belonged to the Key West Angels Motorcycle Club. We were a club mostly of servicemen and women stationed in Key West. Martha, who weighed about 300 pounds, was the only civilian member. Her old man was a shrimper. I had an accident in Miami on my bike, and I was at a gas station there while I recovered from my injuries. Martha said she would take me to Miami to get my bike. She had a Honda 305. That was the biggest Honda at the time. I sat on the back. She was wide, so my legs were not too comfortable with position. I did not think the bike was too happy about a 500-pound load. it seemed to be a little slow, on a slow side. When we got back, we went to a bar where her old man and other shrimpers went. He came in and said something to her, and she did not like it. So she hit him so hard, he went flying out the bar door. They had swinging doors like the old bars on television. He got up and came back in, said something again, and ended up flying out again. Third time was a charm. They kissed and made up. I saw a picture of her before she gained the weight. She was Miss Key West in the picture. Just before you get out of the Navy, they have a shipping over officer trying to convince you to reenlist. Soon after, the captain came to me and chewed me out for convincing a shipping over officer to get out. He got out before I did. The Navy is great for some people. I think every high school graduate should go into the military or an alternative service like the Peace Corps for 2 years before they go to college or entering the workforce. This way they would be more sure of what they want to do, and they will be more mature to continue with their lives. College will be easier for them because of their maturity. I spent 3 years, 15 days, 8 hours in the Navy. When I got out, Vietnam was getting bad. I volunteered, but I failed for the physical.
This concludes Chapter 2. The next chapter, Chapter 3, is called I Do, and that's about my first marriage. This is A Crazy Old White Man from the Hood, written by Lee Gaylord.
Chapter 3. I do? Yeah, after Navy, I went to the Detroit suburbs and soon married a woman whom my mother introduced me to. She was a good-looking woman, and she was a good woman. She would have been a good wife for many men, but she was not the right one for me. I'm not sorry I married her. She had a lot to do with what I am today, and for that I'm thankful. I didn't say I do, I said I do. Ever since high school, I wanted to date black women, but could not because of society. My first wife was white. I never really loved her, but because of society, I could not have what I wanted, so I settled for the best of what I did not want. They were 14 of the worst years of my life. It was not her fault. It wasn't my fault. It was society's fault. I was on my way up the ladder. I became a CPA. Was close to becoming a partner of a medium-sized, high-prestige firm. I was going to parties attended by the wealthy people. We would go out on large pleasure boats. I had a large house in a subdivision with a lake and a dock and a 16-foot sailboat named For Sale. Something was missing. Happiness. Did you ever walk down the street and see someone you wanted to hit in the mouth? I like to think of myself as a nice guy, but the other day I saw myself in the mirror and said, "Self, you're a nice guy." Self is always right. So I must be a nice guy. But, and that's a big but, every once in a while, I run into some clown with a holier-than-thou attitude. They do not have to say anything. You just look at them, and all you see is that
I'm better than you and everyone else look. They do not look you in the eye. They look for something wrong with your appearance. And they find it, and they tell you with their eyes that you have the taste of a peon. You look at them with the I want to pee on you look. You really want to bust them in the mouth. May even think about kicking them in the balls. I went to lunch with my senior on an audit, and the client's comptroller and sales manager. They fit the above description, too, a T. In fact, his picture is on the definition of asshole in the dictionary. He talked the whole meal about class. Who has class? Who doesn't have class? Finally, I said, he who always talks about class has none. My senior looked at me like he was going to cry. The controller almost fell off his chair laughing. Sales manager got red and never said another word to me. In fact, he would not even look at me. That was better than hitting him in the face. Have you ever seen a man leading a donkey on a motel roof? That means bring your own ass. I worked midnights at a motel for a while. I had over 150% occupancy on Friday and Saturday nights. During the week, we were filled up with businessmen who stayed all week. The owner was a strict Southern Baptist. He did not believe in drinking, smoking, premarital sex, or adultery. He owned a motel, weekend premarital sets of adultery, a bar selling drinks and cigarettes, and a restaurant selling cigarettes. Is this hypocrisy? On Friday and Saturday nights, we made almost as much during the week. The rooms were full price for two, but during the week, they were discounted for one. The men would come in and get a room and say they were alone. We knew better and charged them for two. We had them on videotape if they complained. The video cameras covered the whole parking lot. I could zoom in on a license plate. At time, they were in the front and the back, and write down the numbers. Had a map of the parking lot, and I would put the license number and the room number in the parking space. Every 5 or 10 minutes, I would check the lot. And if the space was empty, I would call the housekeeper. The keys were in the room. She would clean it and bring the key to me. I would resell the room. We had coupons for free drinks. They were for Sunday night when the businessmen came in for the week. When we were full and someone came in, if I felt we would have a room in 15 or 20 minutes, I would give the guy a drink coupon and tell him I will call him within a half hour for the room. At first, the boss was mad when he found out. But when I told him how much more money he was making, he said it was a good idea. One night, a guy came in and said he wanted a room for two. When he went to the room, I swung the camera in his direction. He had three women with him. I waited for him to get to the room, and I called him. I said, you owe me for two more women, but if you send one of them down to me, I'll forget about it. He laughed and said, sure, no problem. I said, no, just kidding. With my luck, the boss would catch me. One time, a beautiful hooker came in. She had one breast hanging out. My eyes were going from her face to her breast. She realized what was wrong and stuffed it back in her bra. I said, "It looks good. Why cover it up?" So she pulled it back out. It was really fun when someone I knew would come in. They would say that their wife was in the car. Of course, I would look at the woman with the camera. It was never the wife. One man would come in every Friday and Saturday night. I asked him, "Wouldn't it be cheaper to get an apartment?" He said that would be too easy to trace. They were both married. In telling this, I don't want you to think that this is good. Don't commit adultery or get a divorce, at least separate from your spouse, first spouse, your spouse first. It is a lot better than doing it behind the spouse's back. I was unhappily married to my first wife and looking for an out. I started drinking heavily and became a drunk. One morning I came to the car and there was a big dent in the side of the car. It looked like a fence post. I didn't know how I got there. I told the wife it happened on a mall while I was parked. I don't think she believed me, but I didn't care. 10 years later, I was walking down the street and remembered what happened. It was winter and snowing. I turned on the street and ended up caught in a barbed wire fence. I had to pull the fence post off the car. I had to move the barbed wire so that I could back out. Another time, I was traveling on a winding road. It was raining at 3 in the morning. I went around a 90-degree turn and spun out and ended up with my rear bumper at some guy's front porch. I had about 100 feet to get to the road. The ruts from my back tires had to be 4 inches deep. I was in a bar and a man and a woman were talking, smiling and kissing. Another woman came up and started yelling at the man. She was the wife. She smacked a guy, and he left with his tail between his legs. She and another woman started talking to each other. They started laughing and left together to go out on the town. The wife was unhappy at our house because it was too far from shopping. We had lake privileges, but she and the kids spent the summer in Canada and did not use the beach or the boat. I loved it. I would come home from work and go out on the lake sailing. I told her we could sell the house and move closer to town, but we were going to get a smaller house and less expensive, and I would start my own CPA practice. I had just started my CPA practice, and my first client was a topless bra. The owner, Jack, made Homer Simpson look like a winner. He was lucky once. A bomb was planted in his car, and his bartender went out to start it. Luckily, the bartender didn't close the door when he started it. The bomb went off, and he lost his legs. The open door saved his life. I was a drunk. I had an office in the suburbs. I would leave at noon and go there for lunch until 5 in the afternoon. At six or 7, I would head for home. He could not pay me, so I had open tab. At the end of the month, we would burn the tabs. I was drinking double 151 rum and coke. A fight broke out, My body went flying over my head, and I ordered another double. I had a Kiwanis meeting to go, so I left to pick up a neighbor and take him. We got to the meeting, and the 151 hit me. I was supposed to introduce him to, so I got up and forgot his name. I said, "Gentlemen, I would like you to meet, who in the hell are you?" I never went back. The darling wife and kids were at her parents' cottage in Canada, and I would leave Saturday morning and come home Sunday night. I noticed that the night bartender was not closing the till when he rounded up a sale. This was the first sign of the bartender skimming. I noticed that the nights were much busier than the days. The money turned up from the night shift was less than a day. I told Jack and had him switch nights for a week. The money in the night was now more than in a day. Day sales went down while the number of customers stayed the same. Bartenders fired. The word on the street was that he blamed me and was going to kill me. I got the word back to him that I tried to save his job for him, and he thanked me. He was known for breaking both legs with the swing of a baseball bat that he kept behind the bar. One problem Jack had, among many, was that there was a biker club a block away. The bikers would come into the bar often. Jack had a good working relationship with the president of the club. Jack would let him in the bar, and they would not destroy it. He added a second thing. Don't mess with my accountant. I was sitting at the bar, and a fight broke out. I was calmly drinking my beer, and saw a body flying at me. I ducked just on time and went over my head and landed a foot behind the bar. He moved, so I figured he would survive, and I continued drinking. One day, an IRS agent was coming in, and I told Jack to go to the clubhouse and not come back until I called him. The agent came in, and I had him sit at the stage. He ordered a burger and fries and a beer. Between dances, the dancers came to our table and sat with us and on his lap. We made him feel at home. Bum forgot about what he was there for. This happened once a week for a month. He never did tell me what he wanted. A couple of months later, Jack called me and said, "Lee, I almost killed a couple of IRS agents." I said, "What happened, Jack?" He told me a story. These two agents came in order to supply my records. The one guy threatened me, and I was ready to get my gun. The other one was okay, but he said to give you a power of attorney and bring the records. I went to the IRS. I met the two clowns. I almost died from stupidity. They almost died. I gave them the power of attorney, and they said, "Where are the records?" I said in a calm, collective voice, "You two harassed my client. Sounded like a good guy, bad guy routine. One said, we saw it on TV the night before and thought we would try it." My look was stern. In fact, my best you pissed me off look, and I said, You are lucky to be alive. Someday you're going to try that with the wrong person and get yourself shot. If you ever pull that shit on another one of my clients again, I will see to it that your asses are out of work. Before I continue, I want everyone to know that most IRS agents are dedicated and intelligent. They are good at what they do. I've had problems with only 4 agents. I even did income taxes for some agents. I have found that if you treat an agent with respect and are honest with them, they will give you the same treatment. I told them, there are no records. I can get purchases from the vendors, printouts for other expenses, and bank records for the 3 years. I can get sales tax returns from the state. I know the W-2 forms were filed, so I will get them from you and do the quarterlies based on them. W-2 forms were in a warehouse in Cincinnati. They were not on computer tape. They were never put in the system. Not true anymore, but back then it was. I got what information I could, estimated 3 years of tax returns. His wife worked on the withholding taxes on the returns. I noted that certain figures were estimated and explained how I did it. He got about $3,000 back. The bar was going down the tubes. Jack was an alcoholic and a gambling addict. The bikers had to be kicked out. I convinced him that he should sell out. I hated to do it because I would have to start paying for the booze unless I could put together a deal where I would run it for a percentage. Got another CPA and a lawyer, I knew. The CPA and I came in for lunch. It was slow, so the dancers spent their time with us. The barmaid came over and showed a gun in her belt. She said, "You may want to leave. I may have to blow away the guy at the bar." My man did not want to stick around. Later that day, a woman came in high on drugs. They would not serve her, so she wiped out the cars in the parking lot with her car, mine included. A van was among the casualties, and it was owned by the president of the biker club. Before anything could happen, about 20 cops came in. They were all laughing. They heard the call and thought it would be fun. My car was a 64 Pontiac Le Mans, paid $500 for it, and her insurance company gave me what I paid for it and let me keep the car. It was damaged on both sides, but it ran, got me where I wanted to go. Next day, the lawyer came out. He had a young associate with him. He asked me to let the guy take my car to the office to get his car, and he would drop me off to pick up my car when we were finished. As the guy was driving away, he asked how both sides got banged in. I told him about the woman and how she knocked my car into one next to it and totaled them both. For some reason, he was worried about his car. I told them both that if they put in the money, I could run the place. We would each get a third. I would handle the bikers, the president and most of the others like me. I had talked to them and they said they had a clubhouse fixed up so they would not hang out there anymore. If they came in, they would be without colors and only 2 or 3 of them. One of the new members tried to hassle me by trying to get me to buy him a drink. I told him, I would kick his ass if he didn't leave me alone. The other bikers told him he was on his own. The next day, he had a broken leg and apologized. The deal did not go through. I couldn't convince the bikers to, that it was a safe deal. Today, the bar is a big money maker. I met my second wife there after a new owner took over. A lady I knew was going to buy the bar. She tended bar, or buy a bar. She tended bar at a topless bar at the biker club hang on it. This was another biker club. I knew a few of the members, and I got along with them. The car she was buying was down the street from where she worked. I went in to talk to her about doing her bookkeeping and taxes. After she left, I was talking to the bartender. We noticed that 10 bikers pulled up, and she was worried, so I stayed with her and talked to the bikers. I knew them. That made her feel better. Just as they were getting ready to leave, 4 more came in from another club. Again, I knew them too. I noticed some friction between the two groups. I talked to both groups and they left. I stayed for a while longer and then I left. Bikers can be a big problem. Some of the gangs deal with drugs and firearms. One thing I've always done was treat everyone with respect and as an equal. Because of this, I can usually get along with everyone, even if they're bad guys. I have spent my life studying people. In order to study people, you have to be liked by people. I have known good people. I have known bad people. I have noticed that there is some good in everyone. Well, almost everyone. And there's also some bad in everyone. Whenever you meet someone that you don't like, look for something that is a redeeming quality. Use that quality, and you may have a new friend. And then again, he may be an asshole with no redeeming qualities. Somehow, I never got a drunken driving ticket. I never got pulled over for it. I would leave the office at 11 in the morning and go to the bar for lunch. I would leave the bar at 5 in the afternoon and be home at 6. As soon as I hit the door, I was
there. What she said. The next chapter, chapter 4, is called Strike 2. This is A Crazy Old White Man from the Hood, written by Lee Gaylord.
Strike 2. I went into the bar that Jack sold, and on the stage was my future wife, number 2. She looked like Donna Summers. She's the most beautiful woman I've ever known. She was intelligent, black, and beautiful. Later wore a t-shirt that said, "The love of my life is my black beauty." She had everything I wanted in a woman. She also had the best damn booty I ever did see. Ebony was a dancer and an ex-cop. She would have a customer put his drink on her booty and dance without spilling a drop. That is booty. Suddenly, I went from lily white suburbs to the mostly black hood in Detroit. My friends went from 100% white to 99% black. I found that I was suddenly happy. I also found out that white folks don't know how to have fun. I felt as if I was finally with my people. 10 years later, I was told by 2 psychics that I had a black soul and a white body. I was supposed to be a black man, but got the wrong body. Now I know what transsexuals mean when he says that he is a woman trapped in a man's body. Many of my experiences in the following pages, along with my philosophy, I hope you read them all and learn from them. When I went through my first divorce, I was broke. Ebony supported me for 6 months until I got on my feet. I got a job with an accounting firm and had some clients of my own. The day I left the first wife, I quit drinking in excess. I married Ebony about a year after the divorce. Before we go on, I want it understood that not all bikers' clubs are bad. The American Motorcycle Association sanctions clubs. They are not outlaw clubs. The Hill Gang is a club with members over 40. And in the early 60s, I was in Key West Angels, which had mostly servicemen. I have known many bikers, good and bad. I am not going to mention names or clubs or members. I do not know real names or addresses. All files relating to the bikers I did business with are long gone. Most of the bikers are in prison or dead. Most of the white bikers do not like blacks. My ex-wife knew one that liked her almost as a sister. When he heard that she was getting married, he went by the bar where she worked and said that he wanted to meet me. She called me and asked me to come and meet him. We got along well. And he gave us his blessing. This man looked like a very nice man. He looked like a professional type. His hair was well groomed and he was well spoken. A few years later, I saw him on TV. He was number one on the FBI's most wanted list. 10 most wanted list. Until he was caught that day. He was the national president of one of the most notorious clubs. I did the taxes for bikers, who were also truck drivers. Most were in the same club. It was a club that was thought to be involved in drugs. The feds thought they sold drugs from the truck shops. The first encounter was with a man who had a truck. I only met his wife. I was working for a firm and it would later become mine. The boss asked me to try and collect some old unpaid accounts. And his was the first. His wife answered the door and let me in. She called him into the room. He was big and tough looking. Turned out that he was a real nice guy. He paid me the money and apologized for being late. He was the president of the club at the time. I set up a trucking company for her, the widow of a previous president. She was in her 50s and had a high-paying job with one of the automakers. She bought a few trucks. She financed them all club members were the drivers of her company. I got a subpoena from a U.S. attorney for the records. I took what I had to the man, and he said that the money for the trucking company was from her husband and the club's drugs. They had confiscated the trucks. I told them that according to her income and the fact that all of the trucks were financed, there wasn't much of a chance that the drug money was used. There is no unexplained income. There are statements from the companies that the loads were hauled for. Everything seemed to be in order. The U.S. attorney returned the trucks. A week later, the IRS confiscated the trucks for suspected tax fraud. Tax attorney took over her case, and that was the last I heard from her. But I heard she got the trucks back. If the government wants you for something, they cannot get you. The IRS tries to get you. A few accounting businesses had been robbed in the area. So I carried a 38. A boxer came in. I had known him from Jack's Lounge. A biker came in. I had known him from Jack's Lounge. This guy was a pussycat, but he looked scary. When he left, the receptionist said, "Lee, will you handle the money?" I said, I can't have the interruptions while I'm with the client. If you want, you can have the gun. She said, "No, thank you." I said, "If you're worried about the last client, don't. He's a nice guy and a friend." She felt better. Ebony's great-grandmother was a queen. If you do not believe in voodoo, this might change your mind. I know I would not want to piss this woman off. She never saw a doctor until she turned 100. She went to the hospital, sent her grandniece to get her money for the hospital. She did not trust banks and stashed her money at home. She said the money is in my hope chest under the bedroom window. Find out how much you need and pay the hospital bill. The grandniece went to the house, and the hope chest did not have any money in it. Her going back, she saw her Uncle Billy had bought a brand new car. He bragged that he paid cash for it. He also had a new high-priced suit on. Grandniece went back to the hospital and told her great-aunt about the missing money in Uncle Billy's car. She said, "Billy will get his for that." Billy was driving his new car, showing it off, and it quit on him. He was towed to the shop, and the mechanic could not figure out what was wrong. Put the car up on a hoist, and when it got to the top, it fell off and smashed Billy's legs. At the time, the nurse heard Grandma say, "Gotcha." It looked like we were going to have a problem finding a preacher to perform our wedding ceremony. They did not want to do mixed marriages. I found a minister at my parents' old church in the suburbs. He marched with Martin Luther King. He was white, and he was involved in the civil rights movement. He said that he would do it if we were married in his church. I told him that he would lose his church if he did that. I told them we were doing it outdoors at her parents' house. They had a double lot in the basement that was big enough for a reception. When the bugs drove us into the house, my mother, my brother, sister-in-law, and new wife had birthdays within a week of each of the wedding. So we had a birthday cake and a wedding cake. The day of the wedding, it was raining lightly. Half hour before the wedding, the rain stopped. When the minister pronounced us man and wife, the sun came out. Our honeymoon was in Toronto and Niagara Falls. In Toronto, we took a carriage ride from the hotel to a Chinese restaurant that was the biggest restaurant I've ever seen. The honeymoon was wonderful. It looked like we were going to have a long life together. My new family had a lot of parties. These parties were fantastic. When I got married, my boss, who looked like Robert Goulet, was my best man. He said his girlfriend could not come, so he was going to bring his wife. They were going to get a divorce soon. I told them that 50 of the most beautiful women would be there. He brought his wife, and she messed up his evening. He still said when he remarried and asked my wife and me to come to his wedding, it would not be as much fun as our wedding. We didn't leave until 5 in the morning, and the last people left at 11 in the morning. My children from the first marriage learned that there was another society. They saw the poor and the down and out. They found out that poor black kids were no different than wealthy white kids. When they were with me, they were with blacks. They saw people on drugs. Black and white. And learned what drugs can do to a person. They saw people eating out of garbage cans. The divorce decree said I could not be with the kids in the company of an unwed woman, my girlfriend at the time. After the wedding, I had it changed to every other weekend and every other holiday. First time the kids met my wife, they really liked her. They said she was beautiful. I told them on the way home not to say anything about how good she was. If they asked, they were just to say that she was okay. My daughter said, "Oh, Mama, she was so nice and beautiful." Their mama blew a gasket. Next visitation weekend, she said that they did not want to come, and I took her to court. Before she and her lawyer came in, the judge and my lawyer, another lawyer, were talking. The judge said, "Yesterday a woman was brought before me for non-payment of child support. The son had 6 months before he was 18. The husband said the support would go into a trust fund, and when he turned 18, it would go to him. She said no. So I had to send her to jail." She and her lawyer came in, and the judge asked my lawyers to talk. He told her how the ex-wife would not let the kids come because they suddenly decided that they did not want to come. He said that kids were too young to make the decision. He was quick and to the point. Her lawyer got up and surprised everyone. He said, Your Honor, I realize I'm probably wrong, but here is my case. She took children to a psychologist, and this is her report. He gave the judge a report that said that mixed marriage was bad for them. Judge blew a gasket and said, I don't care what the psychologist said. She is wrong. It is not up to the children if they see their father, but it is up to me. He bought a bigger house, built a bedroom in the basement, so they would each have a bedroom. You will make the children go with their father. If this isn't bad enough, she added, the next time you come before me in this matter, bring the kids, and I will teach them the facts of life. You come again, bring your toothbrush and the kids, because you will go to jail and your husband will take custody. As if it was timed, soon as she said it, a woman she talked about earlier was brought in the courtroom in shackles. She did everything she could to turn them against me. She especially got upset when her husband complimented my wife. We had many problems. When we went to the suburbs, the restaurants would give us poor service. Whites who came in after we did were get served first. We found glass in our food. We got dirty looks. Then we would go to some places and all eyes would be on us. Sometimes they were thinking either she was Donna Summers or how beautiful she was or something bad. I said at least we were the center of attention. We did get some compliments too. The city we would be remembered when we would come back and be treated well. We were in a grocery store and a gay couple came up to us. One said, You're a beautiful couple. We are watching the acceptance of mixed couples because we feel that once you are accepted, we will be close behind. It was a way to my parents. I was on the way to my parents' house, about 100 miles north of the city. My wife and our nephew, who was with me. A cop was on the median facing the south. He turned around and came after us. The speed limit was 55, and I was doing 70. I pulled over, and the cop got out. My nephew said happily, The cop is black. We've got it made. I looked at him and said, Look at me. He said, Oh, I forgot. We're in trouble. The cop said there was a car going the other way. One of us was doing 65 and the other 70. He gave me the ticket for 65. Ebony said, it would have been easier for me to get the other car since we were a mixed couple. He came after us. I agreed. Man came into the office. He said that he was 4 years behind on his taxes and got a notice from IRS. He worked for an elevator repair company and fell 10 floors 4 years before. He spent 6 months in a hospital and has not left his home since he got out of the hospital. A letter from the IRS forced him out. After I took care of his taxes, I never heard from him again. Probably stayed in his house for another 4 years until he got another notice from IRS. Our son is a very intelligent young man. When he was in kindergarten, he was one of two mixed kids in a school. The rest were black. He was as light as me, if not lighter. He came home from school and asked, "Mama, am I black or am I white?" Mama said, "You're black." Put his arm next to mine and said, "If I'm black, then Daddy's black." When he was born, his birth certificate said he was black. Today it would say he's white because he looks white. Blacks know that he's mixed, and whites think he's white. Why don't they just say black and white? There is one thing that a mixed child should never do. It passed for white. My son probably could. There is one big problem. If you marry and a baby comes along, the baby may look black. If you're a woman and a husband will accuse you of sleeping with a black man. If you're a man and she slept with a black man, she would say that it is the other guy's kid. If she did not sleep with a black guy, then she knows that you're black. My father-in-law is the wisest man I've known, except for my father. He reminds me of Lou Gossett Jr. He looks like him, sounds like him, and acts like him. He quit school in third grade to work in the coal mines, took care of his family, but he was wiser than most educated people. Wisdom comes from life, not school. All of the education in the world cannot make a person wise. I wish I could write some of the things he said, but a white man cannot say it in the way he did. My mother-in-law was prejudiced against whites. She would forget that I was white, say things in front of me, and then apologize. I told her not to worry because she was right. Many of my friends did not like whites, but I was accepted. If anything was said, they would say I wasn't white. Didn't know what I was, but I wasn't white. My wife's uncle, now her aunt, dressed as a woman. He took hormones to give him breasts. In his day, he could convince any man that he was a woman. He did not look good as a woman. He did look good as a woman. When a wife met a guy, she would go to his house and leave the guy with him, go downstairs and visit friends. When his hands got to the genitals, there would be a scream and she would dump the guy. Things were good, quite good for us. I became a partner, and a year later, bought out my partner. I had a nice house in one of the best neighborhoods of the city. One day, a big caddy pulled up to my office. Big black man in his high-priced pinstripe suit got out with the lady. They were starting a loan company, and they wanted my help. The next meeting was at the motel, and I met the owner of a very large realty and mortgage company. They also had a letter from a prominent, real rich widow. The banks were against them. They carried guns and included automatics. I got into an argument with them and we broke off our dealings. A while later, I heard on the radio that there was a gunfight at a nearby motel. Paper said that they were con artists, and a reporter called me because he found my card. He did not use an interview because he was saying that they were con artists. My story was that they were actually starting a loan company. This is a street version that I believe. Sons love their mama, and you did not touch her in a threatening way. Before the cops came, they were told that there was a contract out on the mother, and a cop was going to be the hitman. The cops had a warrant for a bounce check. The cop that was killed grabbed Mama's arm, and her son started shooting. The son I met was her number one son. He had a bad case of diabetes, and when the trial came, he was in a wheelchair. He died soon after. The mother and other sons are in prison. Whenever I went to any branch of my bank and deposited checks, they never put a hold on them. We had a branch close to the home, and I went in and there often, and they never put a hold on my deposits. My wife went in, and they told her that they were putting a hold on the checks. Two checks were from that bank. It was a black teller and an assistant manager. When I came home and she told me, I went back to the bank and complained. I told them it was a clear case of discrimination. I had them call the branch manager where I had my account, and he told them never to put a hold on my deposits. One time we gave a retirement party to the father-in-law. We ran a hall that held 200 people. JJ canceled out on a higher-paying gig to do our party. We invited 175 people, and 250 came. Our parties had all kinds of people. My brother-in-law told me he wanted to dance with the woman. I looked at Noah's Adam's apple and said, you don't want to dance with him. He said, every man out there is trying to dance with her. I want to dance with her. Again, I said, you don't want to dance with him. You mean that's a man? Yes. One of the most beautiful women on the dance floor was a man. I had become a partner, and when I bought my partners out, my partner was supposed to take care of the business end, and I took care of the clients. My third partner retired. I owed over $30,000, and over $30,000 was never billed. Some clients owed close to a year in services rendered. A couple of clients ended up owing money for taxes. They were not paid by the firm, but the client paid the firm. In all, I ended up having to pay about $40,000, and I was able only to collect about $5,000. The rest of the amount owed had been written off because of trading services with my partner. My office was predominantly redneck in a redneck suburb. I had two white taxpayers working for me, and they both left at the beginning of the tax season. I hired two black men, and my wife came along to work for me. Willie, the second one I hired, said, Lee, you can't hire me. I answered, why not? He said, most of your clients are rednecks. You will lose clients. I said, Willie, you need a job. Howard worked here last year, and he was well-liked. I know that we will lose some, but I also feel we will gain some. If we change one redneck's mind, it will be worth what we lose. He had a car in a week. He also had a gambling problem and a drug problem. He made it to work on schedule, so I did not notice the problem until he came by my house with a hooker at 3 in the morning needing money to buy his car back. He lost it in a poker game. Next day, his wife left him. Last month, Howard and I ran into each other at the office by store. It had been 10 years since we had seen each other. And he said Willie died of a drug overdose. The next tax season, business dropped in half, and I lost the office and had to move it into the city. I saw that I was going broke. My wife was insanely jealous. The marriage is going downhill. I did not want her and her son to go down with me. So before we lost everything, I signed the house over to her. I had made extra payments, and in the 4 years, he cut the mortgage in half. And the equity was about $60,000. Add to that the cash and furniture, my half will have been over $40,000. She had a good job and was well paid. I let her have it all, and I left. I feel that I prepaid the child support. The funny thing is that a psychic who worked for me said that I would leave my wife on July 31st. We gave her no indication that there was a problem. She was right. She also made other predictions would happen. She said I had a black soul. She was right. I left and went.
Next chapter, chapter 5, is single again. Thank the Lord I'm single again. This is A Crazy Old White Man from the Hood, written by Lee Gaylord.
Chapter 5. I'm single again, thank the Lord, I'm single again. Here comes the fun. I was single and alone for the first time in 24 years. I was 45 and starting a new life again. After split up number 2, I met up with a dancer. She went by a stage name of the Whip. We went to her place where she rented rooms to 3 other dancers. She found out that I was staying in motels and offered to rent a room to me. She said the ladies would clean and cook for me. They were all beautiful. But the other 3 were lesbians. So I only had 1 for me. The Whip and I had finished doing our thing, and 2 of the other women asked if they could join in. Sadly, I had to go. I decided not to move in for many reasons. The funny thing is, my estranged wife told my parents that I lived in a whorehouse. I almost lived with 4 women. That's close. I went into the bar, and there was a dancer on stage. She was tall, slim, and so fine. I gave her a tip while she was on stage. I said, I'm Lee. Act like we're old friends. In a mixed bar, some of the white dancers would get jealous of the black dancers' popularity with the white men. I've had friends who've had their costumes trashed by the white dancers. My Fatal Attraction, whom you will meet later, had her car vandalized by the other dancers. She got off the stage and we talked. She said, my name is Julie. I asked, do you have a man? Her answer saddened me. I have a live-in boyfriend that I am trying to get rid of. He's abusive, and he was convicted of battery when he pushed me down the stairs. He was sentenced to 6 months, and is supposed to go to jail in a month. I said, well, I'm separated wife and hope to be divorced soon. I don't have much money, so if that is what you're looking for, I am not the one. I want a woman who's not in my pocket. I will not ask you for money. If we get together, I will be honest. I will always give you respect, and when you are down, I'll pick you up. Would you like to go to breakfast when you get off? She looked at me in the eye and said, will you marry me? I asked, how many kids do you want? Her answer floored me, 10. My retort was not. For the next month, she would come to the office, my motel, or we would go to her place when a boyfriend was at work. Spent a lot of time at the bar, and we would sit in the corner where the boss could not see us. We and other dancers would sit, talk, and plot to play practical jokes on other dancers and the customers. One night I came into the bar and went to a dancer on stage and said, baby, time to go home. The kids need you. Billy got into a fight and got a broken nose. Jimmy fell on her bike. Little Joe was constantly crying, Mama! We started arguing. I grabbed her and threw her over my shoulder and carried her out of the bar. The bouncer, the manager, and a few other dancers knew what was happening. When the guy that lived with Julie went to jail, she wanted me to move in. They would not have enough room in the jail. And he had a good job, so they put him on the tether for 6 months. He would not move out. We decided to try and get him sent to jail. I dropped her off by the house and went around the corner. She was going to go in and come to my car, and we were going out. We were hoping he would stop her, or he would come after me. He did and chased me in his car. I headed for the main road in hopes the cop would stop us. I would say he was chasing me, and he would go to jail for violating his probation. I got to the main road, and he stopped and went back. The reason he was in trouble with the law was that he assaulted her. He was smart enough not to hurt her again. I told her that until she moved out, I was not going to see her. She got a place later, but it was in the suburbs. It cost $750 a month. I said, I can't pay my share of the rent. She said, I can pay it. Just pay what you can on the other expenses. I said, what happens if you fall on a stage and break your leg? She got a couple other dancers to share with her. My sister-in-law came to me and offered a room in her house next to her parents for $75 a month. We were like brother and sister, and I moved into her spare room. She had a cat that was prejudiced. She would not come out when she would come out when blacks were there, but hide when I came home. It took a week for her to decide that I wasn't white. After that, she slept with me, the cat, that is. A friend of the ex and mine had a van with Donna Summers on it. He was proud of that van. When he and my wife were together, people would ask if it was her on the van. I hadn't seen him in a while, and I saw the van without him. The van was looking bad. I knew he hung out near where I was living. It was a topless bar that my ex started dancing at. I went in, and I was the only white guy there. The bouncer would not help me until I showed her my ex. He remembered her. He told me that our friend died of a heart attack. I got to know the bouncer and started going there. When I came in, and the guys didn't say much, but the women gave me hugs and kisses. Other whites would come in and were not made welcome and left quickly. I asked the bouncer why I didn't have a hassle. I learned a lesson. He said that he spread the word that I was a hitman. You may be wondering about all the dancers and topless bars. You may or may not buy this. I am a people watcher. Topless bars have all kinds of people to watch. There are also a lot of lost souls there. I help lost souls. You have to go where they are. The bars and the streets. And along comes Fatal Attraction. I was in a bar and I met Danielle. She was on the stage, and I gave her a tip. When she got off, she came over to my table and introduced herself. I told her my name and told her I was an accountant. I did tax returns for a few of the dancers. Danielle said, "I'm an accountant. I have 3 years' experience in my degree. I just can't find a job because I'm a black female. Most white firms wouldn't hire blacks, especially women. Black firms don't pay enough. I make more money dancing. Are you hiring?" I looked at her and I asked her about her experience. After hearing about what she could do, I said, "I am no longer a CPA. I dropped the CPA because I got tired of the state regulating my business and having to charge clients for unnecessary work to cover my ass and make the regulators happy. I do need some help. I can't pay you on a per job basis. I can pay you on a per job basis when I get paid. If you bring in clients, you will get 25% of collected billings. If you bring in enough work and do good work, and if we get along, I will make you a partner." Danielle said, "I'll keep dancing until we get going well enough for me to quit. If we don't become partners, I will at least have enough experience to go out on my own with clients I bring in. We'll dance until it's big enough to support me. I want it to be strictly business." I agreed, and she was supposed to start the thaw on Monday. The day Danielle was supposed to start, she did not show up. I called her mother, who had a hatred for whites, and said she was in the hospital. She would not tell me where or why. Danielle called and said, "I'm in the psych ward at the osteopathic hospital. I'll be here for at least 30 days. Can you come and visit?" I said I could and visited her daily. She was manic depressive. Manic depressive is now bipolar. And so was her mother, whom she lived with. When she got out, she came to work. Then she went to Chicago to see her father for a long weekend and had a glass of wine. That and her medication landed her in the Illinois State Hospital. I had a call from the doctor in Illinois, and he asked if I could give her a place to stay. She could not stay with her mother. Danielle moved into the office. An old girlfriend and Julie called, and Danielle answered. She said, "Leave my man alone, you crazy bitch." Danielle said to me, "Part's right, but I'm not a bitch." Soon I met a new girlfriend. She tended bar, and of course a topless bar. Fatal Attraction wasn't happy. Came in the office one morning, she was sitting on the desk in only a t-shirt. She opened her legs and asked, "Do you want this?" I was tempted. We did have sex once before, then decided we should keep it business. Many times I would be there late, and we'd come close, but I decided not to jeopardize the business relationship. I answered, "Danielle, you know I'm involved with someone else, and you are the one that said that we should keep our relationship strictly business. I think it would be best if we ended this. I will give you 2 weeks to find a place to live." That was not the right answer. She stopped taking her meds and became a nutcase. She called the clients and told them to come and get their files. She was going to burn down the building. I lost some business. I called the police and asked how to get her out. The cop said, "Throw her out and her stuff out." I said, "Isn't that illegal? She could have me arrested for assault and battery." Cop agreed and said, "Hopefully she doesn't know that." I had the locks that she had the key for. I left for a while, and I had the locks changed that she had the key for. I left for a while and left a note on the door telling her that she could pick up her stuff at 5 in the afternoon. When I came back, my key wouldn't work. I had double pane glass window and iron bar door. Her desk was by the door, and I saw paper from a locksmith I used. I called the company, and said, "I had the locks changed in front gate of the door. You then sent someone out to change them again. Why did you come out the second time?" The lady said that she rented the place and lost her key. We didn't know that it was the same one that we did earlier, until you just told me. Someone else took the second order. It was a different locksmith that went out. I was cut, and I told them, "Now you have to change them again." "Did she pay you with a check?" "Yes," the guy said. "She had checks with the address out. That's why we figured it was all right to change them." I was incensed. I asked him, "If I have your address on my checks, will you have your locks changed for me?" He said, "That's different." I said, "No, it's not. You're supposed to have proof that the person is in the position to change the locks. I had a letter from the owner of the building saying that I was a tenant and I had his approval to change the locks. Now you have to change the locks for the third time. Since her check will bounce, you only get paid once. He sent a guy right out. I found out later that the check did bounce. She came at 5 and I had her stuff out for her. I had the gate locked and the inside door open. She was not happy and started making a scene. Owner of the bar next door called the police. This was the third time they were called because of her. And about 10 cars came because they all wanted to watch. They helped her put the stuff in her car and they all left. I had an answer machine taped full of threats in my office. I was still living at his sister-in-law's and she called there. We screened the calls and it was just too much for the sister-in-law, so I ended up moving into the office. I played the tapes to the police and they said they could not do anything until she followed through with her threats. Her probation officer said if I would have her arrested for trespassing, she could violate her parole, her probation, if she was convicted. The investigators from AT&T came looking for her for credit card fraud. She used her mother's card. I would imagine that they found her. Never saw her again. The cause for the problem with fatal attraction was Cassandra. I met her at the Topless Club I went to. She was the barmaid. She had one problem. She was afraid of the mixed relationship. I found out later that she was only 21. I was 46. Her mother was 36. Cassandra had a brother, and Cassandra, a brother, and I were north of Detroit. It wasn't a good place for mixed couples. My plate was expired in the middle of the month. Normally, you have until the end of the month before they give you a ticket. The cop was a sheriff's deputy supervisor in plain clothes. He saw us and pulled us over and called in my plate number and found that it was expired, and so was my driver's license. I got 2 tickets. I was told to get out of town. The only reason he checked was that we were a mixed couple. Whenever I rode with her and her brothers and a couple friends, we would get pulled over by narco. Flat out told me that one white guy and a bunch of black guys in a car means drug dealer. Cassandra, her brothers, and I went to pick up a guy downriver in Detroit. On the way back, I got pulled over for speeding. The cop sat in his car for a long time. We were wondering why. All of a sudden, 4 cop cars showed up. The friend in the back looked worried. Finally, the cop came to the car. I gave him my license and registration. Both were expired. Oops. He gave me 3 tickets, sent the rest of the police force 3, and let us go. The guy in the back seat looked sick. He had a bag of weed with him. The next time he rode with us, narco pulled us over. Someone left a joint in the ashtray. I saw it when the cop did. I looked at him, and he smiled, and I smiled, and he said, "Don't worry. We're looking for crack." What really made me mad was that whenever we were stopped, the white cops hassled the black guys, and the black cops talked to me. Black cops were always nice to me. One time, I let Cassandra's brother use the car. He picked her up at the club and came by my place. I took him home. I was a block outside of the next city. The cops in that city, the cops in my city, do not get along. Big city versus small city cops. When I went down the alley on the street that divides the two cities, two cops from my other city were in a car. When I came back, they were still there. They followed me through the alley to my door. They got out of the car and started looking at my car with flashlights. This pissed me off. I said, "What the hell do you two assholes think you're doing?" No answer. I said, "This is my car, my office, my parking lot, and the city of Detroit. If you do not get the hell out of here now, I will go inside and call the real police and have you thrown in jail for trespassing." They took off because they knew I meant it, and they knew Detroit cops who loved to bust. Cassandra's mother was a psychic and an astrologer. She made a lot of predictions that came true. She did my chart and looked at me. I asked her what the problem was. She said, "No problem. According to this, you're black." Sound familiar? I am a black man in a white man's body. That is why I'm the way I am, if it's true. She and I became good friends. She worked for me, and we spent more time together than Cassandra and I. To me, it was a business and friendship relationship. I had no sexual desires for the mother. She was the mother of a woman I loved. Cassandra could not handle the pressure of the mixed race relationship. She was dark-skinned, and she felt that her dark skin would make things even worse. I could not convince her that there was no problem, especially since we already had problems. Her fear made it impossible for us to get together. We loved each other, and her children loved me too. But the fear could not be overcome. We broke up. I was hanging out at a bar shooting pool. I was there almost every night, and I got pretty good. One night, I held the table for 18 straight games, and I met up with Valerie. Cassandra's mother was still working for me. I was living above the office. She came in one morning, and Valerie came down. Cassandra's mother could not handle it and quit. She said she loved me and wanted to marry me. Soon I found out that Valerie was a crack addict. I had drug dealers coming to me for money that she owed. One time, she called me. She said that Joe was holding me until you come with $80 that I owe him. I said, "Tell him to bring you here. I'll have someone bring me the money. I'll give him the money when he hands you over to me." He said he would send his dog with her to get the money. Money man came to the office. When the dealer's flunky got there with her, the money man called me on a cell phone from a big car, from his Lincoln. And the flunky thought he was mafia. I got the money and went to the flunky's car. Gave the money to the flunky and said, "Valerie, get out of the car and get into the office." I looked at the flunky and said, "I know you're just a runner for Joe. So, I'm not pissed at you. Tell him that if he pulls this shit again, he will never be able to pull it a third time. Because I will have him killed. In the future, before dealing with her, get something of value and call me." I will pay when the item is delivered. At this time, I knew a lot of drug dealers. The word on the street that I was a crazy old man and not to mess with me. Some of the dealers spread the word for me so that the others would not mess with me. I'm a big guy, and in the streets I show no fear, and I don't take any BS. People look at me, and they do not know who want to mess with me. Most places I go, I am the only white person around. I cannot be missed. One night, she called me and asked, "Can you come and get me? I want to go to rehab. I'm down the street from my mother's house. Please come. I love you, Lee." I had to call a cab. Driver picked me up, and we went to get her. We got to her, and she said she wanted a rock before we go to my place. I said no, and she would not get into the car. Cab driver said, "Hey, man, I've been through this, and I knew that you are better off getting the rock." I said, "Okay, we'll get it." She got the rock, and we went to my place. She sat on the bed and smoked her rock. When it was gone, she started rocking back and forth. She kept saying over and over again, "I've got to have another rock." Little Mouse, that would sit with me when I worked late at night, came up to her feet and looked up at her. She saw the mouse and said, "I've got to go to bed." She laid down and went to sleep. I looked at the mouse and said, "Thank you, my little friend." It looked at me and went away. In the morning, I went and got my car while she went home. I hadn't met her mother yet because she didn't like white people. I had to go to her house and take my girl to the beauty shop. Mama's boyfriend, her daughter's age, answered the door. He looked at me with a look that could kill and said, "What in the hell do you want?" I told him, "I'm taking Valerie to get her hair done. She'll be out in a minute." He slammed the door in my face. He came back to the door and told me to come in and wait. Her mama walked out in her boyfriend's shirt. And ooh-wee, was she nice. She saw my white face and almost did a Fred Sanford. Not a word was said until Valerie introduced us. Then there was only a hello from each of us. The next morning, I took her to detox. I wrote a letter to her mama. Told her that I understand her feelings, but if she wanted her daughter to get better, it would take both of us working together. We became friends after that. Valerie came home from a 7-day detox program, but never went back for the 30-day program. After rehab, we went to a client up north. We were told that a bar in Memphis, Michigan, had all-you-can-eat prime rib for $9.95. We went there on the way home, and when we got to the door, we could hear the people. So we walked in. Then you could hear a pin drop. A guy at the pool table said, "You guys aren't from around here, are you?" Everyone laughed and the party began. Valerie was a pool hustler. She beat everyone in pool. Well, I ate. She had a few bites while she shot pool and snuck some food out in her purse. She was clean for a month. It was a beautiful month. Our love grew and she seemed happy. We talked about marriage. Her mother and I got along well. Her mother was 8 years younger than me. She looked 20 years younger. I called her mom and she laughed. I had $700 saved up for a long weekend we were going to take to celebrate. The night before, she said that she had some work to do before going. I went to sleep, and she disappeared with half the money, leaving a note asking forgiveness. The rest was gone in a week. When she came home, she asked me to lock her in the office apartment for a week. I bought her food, and she drank a lot of fruit juices. I hated locking her in when I went out because she did not know a way out. It was hard. When I was home, I hid the key so that if I fell asleep, she couldn't get it out of my pocket. After the week was up, she went on another binge. She tried another week locked up, and that did not work. She needed a longer program. She told me she was going out with her friend. What she did not realize was that this friend was a friend of mine, too. Her friend called me and asked for her. I said, she said she was going out with you. She said, I think she may be with Randy. He supplies her with drugs. Does she have your car? I said, yes. She said she would check it out and get back to me. She came by my place and picked me up. She took me to the corner about a half a block from his house and told me the car was in the driveway. It was after midnight, so I stole my car. Then I called in the morning. Do you have your car? I said, no, I don't have it. She said, it must have been stolen. I stayed over, I cut her off, and said, you stayed at Randy's and got high. I guess he gives you drugs for sex. I did not have the car. I will come and get my keys. I will also put the word out that Randy is paying for your drugs and not me. About a year later, she called from the hospital. Randy broke her leg. She needed a ride to her mother's house. At the time, I did not have the car and could not help her. I saw her a few years later. She was clean. I heard before that she had a baby and stopped when she found out she was pregnant. The baby is now about 7. And last year when I saw them, the little girl was real cute and a smart little thing. Allie put on a lot of pounds, but she looked great. I spent a lot of time at the Chicago Lounge. That's a neighborhood bar in the hood. I was one of the two white regulars. There was a gay bar across the street. One night, a gay guy got lost and came in. The customers really didn't care. He just sat there with a shit-eating grin and listened to the music. His story is not anti-gay. I have no problem with gays. What you do is what you do. And I have to say, have no say. This is in the story because I think it's funny. One of the older regulars, Cal, came up to me and said, Lee, see that white guy? I answered, yes, so what? In case you haven't noticed, this is a black bar. He is white. He is gay. It's two strikes against him. Cook was here when it was a white bar. just never noticed the changing color of the neighborhood and the clientele of the bar. Since he was here first, we can't send him away. You came here and we all liked you. You're like a brother, and a lot of times we forgot that you are white. When we badmouth your race, you agree, and you fit in with the conversation. We decided you ain't white and accepted you. The problem is that he strikes. Cook has a strike, and you have a strike. That, by my addition, is four strikes. That is one strike too many. The gay guy left and went to the bar across the street. Every once in a while, he would come to Chicago Lounge and sit there with a shitty grin and enjoy the great music, shoot pool every once in a while. Sure, he was different. So was everyone else. If you get rid of the people because they're different, you'll be the only one around. The differences are the things that make us interesting and give us something to talk about. Cal was shooting a good stick. He held the table for about 10 games. I was up, and I have been hot lately. We were down to the 8-ball. He missed. So he started to put up a stick. I had a good side pocket shot. I said, "Don't put up your stick, Cal. I'm going to miss this one." Cross corner. He got his stick back and asked why. I said, "Because it's there." That sucker went so fast you couldn't see it goes into the pocket. Cal stood there with his mouth open. Said sadly, "You lied. You said you were going to miss it." I said, "How many times have you been told that you can never trust a white man?" Smith, the owner, will get mad at me because I would shoot cross corners and cross sides and double bank shots and combination shots when I had straight in shots. I just told them I needed to practice. But when I did it, they were dead shots. Sure thing. Smith was pushing 70, but he was tall and tough. You did not mess with Smith. There was a customer that would get drunk and play the jukebox and laugh and dance by himself. He didn't bother anybody, and nobody said anything. A young man was in the bar, and the dancer accidentally knocked into him. He started yelling at our favorite drunk, and everyone in the bar was getting ready to stop him. The guy was starting to swing, and Smith grabbed his arm. He said, "You MF, you're out of here." The guy screwed up and said he wasn't going. Was pissed. He grabbed the guy by the collar and the belt, carried him to the door. Customer opened the door, but the guy's head was open, and he was thrown out. 15 minutes later, he came back and asked for his briefcase. He apologized to Smith and our resident drunk. He bought a round for the bar and stayed until closing. I was a pretty good player. If I was more consistent, I could have been a pool shark. I was told that I had an eye for pool. I could spot combinations and banks that were dead shots. The only problem is my stick sucked. As I got better, I would shoot real well with the difficult shots, but I would choke up on the easy shots. Phyllis was my friend's sister. She had a good stick and a good body, too. The first time she played, I had held the table for about 5 games. She said, "Don't let up on me. Play your best." I played a good game, but I choked up on my 8-ball and missed an easy shot. She said, "You missed that on purpose." And she sank the ball and left, and she had left and got the 8-ball. Next time I came up, she broke, and I ran the table. You didn't have to be so rough on me. I figured it was PMS time. Art would sign in on the board drawing a crown. He said he was a king of pool. I said he was a king. He would talk the whole game about how good he was going to beat your butt. I came up and he said, "I'm going to leave you with 4 balls on the table." I looked at him in the eye. "You pissed me off. When I finish with you, that crown will be a piece of shit." I blocked everything out of my mind but the pool table. I didn't hear the music or Art's mouth. He only sank 1 ball on a break. Missed a second shot, and I ran the table. Art said, "That was a lucky game. I'll get you when you get the table back." To make him feel worse, I played a bad game and lost and left. The next night, he was there. He still signed in with the crown, still had a big mouth. Next game I played the same way, with total concentration on the game. This time I ran some on the first turn and the rest on the second. And the next game I lost and left. Next night he came in later than usual. Signed in his Art. When he got to the table, he wasn't as good as usual. But he said to me, he really got to him. He talks about, all he talks about is beating you. I said, "I noticed you signed in with his name. His mouth isn't as active either. Don't worry about it. He will win, but he will have to work for it." I got down to the 8-ball and missed. He sank his last 2 balls and missed on 8. I had a long but straight in shot for the 8-ball. I looked at him, his mouth was shut. He looked like he was ready to cry. If I made that shot, I would win the game, but break the spirit. I decided that I was going to shoot the 8-ball hard, have it bounce out of the pocket and go across the table into the other corner. The devil in me said, caught like I was going to do it. And the good guy said, call the corner, I'm going to pop it out of. The good guy won. I shot so hard and fast that he thought I made it, then noticed that it went to the other corner. He shook my hand and was himself again, with 2 exceptions. The crown was gone, the mouth was tamed. From then on, I won about half the games I played him. I went back to shooting pool for fun and enjoying the game and my opponents. It was about 3 a.m. when I was waiting outside the bar after a night of pool for a cab. 3 guys in a van showed up and slowed down and pulled over the curb about a half block away. They just stood there for a few minutes. I was thinking it was going to be a robbery, and I was the only one to rob. I looked at the van. I reached in my pocket with one hand and motioned them with the other to come and get me. They probably thought I was reaching for a gun and took off. Another rule for the hood is that if someone's coming towards you, they reach into their coat pocket, you reach into yours. Odds are they will take their hand out. I was back at my favorite bar shooting pool. I was wanting. Until a good-looking woman walked in. She came to the jukebox and asked, "Where do the quarters go in?" "It takes dollars. Here, let me take care of it for you." I put the dollar in for her, and I said to her, "If I had the money, I would take you out on the town. But I don't, so I won't." I went back to my game and lost. She was sitting at the bar with a beer. I had enough money to buy her a beer. So I went to her and bought her one. I had a glass of water for myself. Her name was Bernice. And she said, "A guy is supposed to pick me up. It's a blind date. Why don't you give me your phone number in case it doesn't work?" And I went home. Half hour later, she got home and called. I had a drink with him and didn't like him, so I had him take me home. "I have some corned beef and cabbage if you're hungry." My office was 5 blocks away. I lived in an upstairs above my office. I said, "I'll be there in a half an hour." She asked, "Why so long?" "I want to shave and clean up." "That was the wrong answer," she said. "If you aren't here in 5 minutes, I will not open the door." I was there in 3 minutes. She had a friend there as a chaperone. It was love at first sight. Saw her every day after that. 3 days later, we went to the office and the fire department was there. Front of the first floor, which was another business, burned out. The office, the front, was going to be a resale shop and include the basement. There was a lot of junk in there. And I had the back and the upstairs. There was no damage to my part except for smoke. Bernice told me I could stay with her for 3 days until we could get rid of the smoke smell. Those 3 days ended up being 6 months. Her daughter Candy adopted me as her daddy. Before she was two, she could say, "He is my daddy." The son, Ray, was 16. Very troubled. Bernice was an alcoholic and a crack addict. She took care of the rent, utilities, and the food. I took care of her crack and our beer. One night, she and her sister took Candy out to get some more beer. I was asleep. They took my car. When they came to the intersection, there was a green light. The driver of the car coming from the other direction was being beaten on by her boyfriend. She went into Bernice's lane and hit a current or head on. Someone was pounding on the door and yelling my name. It was Bernice's mother. She said Ray called and Bernice was in an accident. I will take you there. We got there and the EMS technician was helping Bernice up. I ran towards her as they were putting her in the EMS truck. Cop tried to stop me, but I stiff-armed him and continued on. Her mother told me that I was her man. They put Bernice and her sister and me holding Candy and the driver of the other car in the EMS truck and took us to the hospital. By the time we got to the hospital, Bernice was out of it. Candy had a bump on her head. Sister had a broken nose, and her lip was badly cut. Driver of the car had a broken leg. The boyfriend was not hurt. At the hospital, the rest of Bernice's family showed up. Since Bernice couldn't give consent, and there was not one that could, I said I was Candy's father, so they could treat her. Afterwards, Social Services asked me why her birth certificate had another father on it. I told them I lied so that she would be treated. That was all that was said about it. In the emergency room, I went back and forth between Bernice and Candy. Candy was okay. Bernice spent 2 weeks in the hospital, and her sister was treated and released. The girl driving was treated and released. The boyfriend got beat up by Bernice's brother and son. They dropped him off at the emergency entrance, where he was treated and admitted. In Michigan, if you're in a car accident with a minor child in the car, and if there are any alcohol or drugs in your system, it can be considered child abuse. Because you put a child in danger. This is even if the alcohol level is too low for a ticket. If you're not charged with child abuse, you will be investigated. If you have a reputation of drug or alcohol abuse, you may lose your child. When I was with Bernice, in order to keep her out of danger, while I was trying to help her get off the crack, I bought her drugs. If I got busted, I will go into prison for selling drugs. If you possessed drugs and did not use them, you were charged with sale. Under law, I was selling drugs for a place to live and sex. I would have done hard time. But I deserved it. If you can't do the time, don't do the crime. If you're busted for possession, depending on the amount, in Detroit, and you are a user, the odds are that you'll be sent to rehab on a first offense.
Chapter 5 will be continued. Chapter 5 will be continued.